Hi, how you doing? Welcome to In Too Deep. I'm your host, Jack Rowland. And today, the 21st of October, I believe is our last day of lockdown. Wow, that was really something. Well done, Melbourne. I hope you've all kept somewhat sane. And I'm really looking forward to relearning how to socialize and figuring out how to not talk about COVID this summer. Today, I have a chat with the one and only John Safran. John has done so many things, his career is hard to sum up. John is a writer, a journalist, a radio host, a satirist, and a documentary filmmaker, creating such shows as John Safran vs. God and Race Relations. He explores a wide variety of subjects, including religion, race and racism, cultural fringes, true crime, and politics, always approached with keen curiosity and delivered with humor. I've just finished his book, Depends What You Mean by Extremist, which I thoroughly enjoyed. And I've just started his newly released book titled Puff Piece, How Philip Morris Set Vaping Alight and Burned Down the English Language. I love his work, and I hope you guys love this chat. Please welcome John Safran.
Is there a point to all this?
I think we're getting in too deep.
You don't apply. Bad luck.
Oh, I have one speed, I have one gear. Go, 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 go.
I'll tell you when we're getting into deep.
John Safran, thank you so much for joining me. I've been a fan for many years of your stuff. Actually, I just think you've created the coolest career for yourself, really. Just kind of a combination of just all the subjects that I find incredibly interesting, writing, journalism, and of course comedy, all into one. Yeah, thanks for all the stuff you do. It's great.
I guess sometimes I forget that I've invented my professions.
Mm.
So, yeah. For instance, I was never a documentary maker until I was a documentary maker. and probably 6 months before I was a documentary maker, it had never occurred to me to be a documentary maker. It's just an opportunity arrived where the ABC put out a promotion saying they're looking for eight young people who've never been in the media before to shoot some, documentaries for a show. And I'm not even sure how many documentaries I'd even seen. I mean, I'm sure I had. I would have had to have seen some documentaries, but I definitely never like ruminated over the idea of, yes, this is going to be my future. And then it just became that. And then I just decided I wanted to be a true crime writer. And so I became a true crime writer. And I hadn't read any true crime books before. Again, an opportunity arose, which, I mean, that's a bit tacky because it does involve a murder. I'm talking about my first book, Murder in Mississippi, I hung out with all white supremacist when I was still a documentary comedian. 10 months before I became a true crime writer, I was hanging out with a white supremacist in Mississippi for a little prank documentary story. And anyway, he started legal action against the ABC so we could never broadcast it. But then I'm back home, and it was 11 months later, so not even a year later, and I find out he's been murdered by a young black dude who claims that this white supremacist hit on him and he had to defend himself. I was like, what the hell, or whatever. And then I was like, it just felt like I should be covering this in somehow, but like it takes ages to get funding and the practicalities of filming TV or whatever. And then I just had this because this was pre the true crime revival. You know how there was that podcast Serial?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then suddenly everything exploded. Something like true crime's like the biggest thing in the world, or at least this neo or whatever, new true crime. And this more, what would you even call it? I guess not casual true crime, but sort of amateur true crime, where it's like, well, I've never done a true crime thing before this. But anyway, so God damn it. This is like before Serial. So it was like, it was a bit weird that, like, why the hell are you doing a true crime book? Like, that's up. And so anyway, so then when I had this kind of idea to do a true crime book, And I hadn't read any true crime books. Sorry, that's not true. I was just coincidentally reading In Cold Blood.
Great book.
By Truman Capote. And then I read Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, because on like Amazon it said, if you like this, you'll like this. So I started reading that, and something clicked when I was reading Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, because that's set in the South. And I was going, oh, my God, I should do something like this, because true crime writing can be a bit like my documentary work, where it's like I'm an outsider, a fish out of water, and I go into a town that's like the, you know, contradictory culture to mine, and I'm like snooping around, and I was like, oh, my God. And I was like, all I need is a murder. Like, and so I was really looking like, you know, doing a bit of, you know, Australia's Got Talent, but on murders, where I was searching out a murder. And like, for instance, I think I met up with Father Bob, for instance, because I knew he knew something like that. I was like, and then this is how like dumb I can be. I'm reading this book set in the South in America, and I'm going, oh, I'd love to investigate a murder, but I need a murder. And it took me weeks for it to click. Oh, that's right. I know that white supremacist in the South in America who was murdered. And so, and then as soon as I clicked on that, I was like, I just have to get over there. Like, the trial's not going to wait for me. And so I just bought a ticket off my own bat and just had my like audio recorder and a notebook. And I think I spent like a month there or something. I don't know. And then the case got delayed. So then I came back and I had just all this material, because I'd been going through all the files there. And then I went to Penguin Books. Like, I went to pitch it around. I went to Penguin Books, and I'm in their boardroom. And I've got my big box of FBI files from Mississippi, and like looking like a lunatic. And then they're like, oh, yeah, do this. Yeah. And so therefore, I guess the point of that is like, suddenly I'm a true crime writer. But I just like made it up, and
I mean,
there's all these things I just make up. Like, for instance, I really liked my reality on Music Jamboree, which was this show, and it was very theatrical. There was lots of like me dressing up. I really liked that stuff, but. You know, I've also got to take in mind what people like from me. So people seem to like from me when I do a bit of legit journalism, and then I twist it. They don't like it when I'm just doing a performance, silly. Like, I don't think I can quite pull that off, or there's not really the audience for that.
Right.
So
right.
Yeah. Blah blah blah.
I mean, you're kind of talking about doing true crime before true crime really blew up. But I kind of feel like you know, the first time I came across you was John Safran versus God, and now we've kind of got this like. I don't know, funny category of, I guess, journalism with like Louis Theroux. You've got New Zealand guy's name who does Dark Tourist, which is a great show on Netflix.
David Farrier.
That's it, yeah. Yeah, I feel like you're kind of the...
Both my friends.
Oh, really?
Both my friends.
Great.
Yeah.
You're kind of the
OG. Met them in
the
real OG, life.
The original kind of propagator.
Oh, no, I think Louis Theroux was before me or whatever. But, yeah, I mean, the other context for me is... just so if anyone watches my old work, is that it was before, you know, like it was a touch before things like Ali G or Jackass or...
Right.
So, yeah, it is kind of weird that sort of like... having said that, that style has been done in previous generations, so I'm not pretending... And I kind of leant towards that, and I was aware of that. So I'm not pretending. I'm not saying I made up anything or whatever like that. I'm just saying it was kind of like curious that around the same time, and this was, even though technically speaking there was the internet, it wasn't like it is now. It wasn't social media or whatever. It was like, for instance, if people were like, "Oh, John, there's this Michael Moore film you've got to see," even though technically speaking the internet was up, they wouldn't give you a link. They'd give you a dub of a VHS,
you know,
like that they got from their friend in America who'd come over on an airplane or whatever. So Just even though I wasn't really aware, I wasn't aware of Michael Moore, but he had done this film called Roger and Me, where he's chasing after the head of General Motors or whatever. So, but I wasn't aware of that when I started doing my stuff. And then, yeah, then it was weird that just in different places in the world, there was obviously like something going through the atmosphere of like social satire pranking has to become a thing again. And then suddenly there's like Ali G and there's Chris Morris in the UK and there was me in Australia. And yeah, it was just kind of a thing. And of course now it's like I can't really do that anymore unless I came up with a really killer idea, because everything's that now.
Right.
like YouTube is that. YouTube, a lot of it is social experiments and you know, silly vox pops and all that kind of jazz, which is totally cool or whatever. I'm not complaining about it. It just means you have to zig when the others zag.
Right. You know, like, sure.
I can't be like dressing up as a ferret and turning up on the steps of Parliament and expecting anyone not to go, Jesus Christ, where did it all go wrong for John? Which is like, why? Yeah, which is why, like, for instance, like, that's really part of the reason, like, my new book is, like, so thoroughly journalistic. And then I put all my silly stuff on it. It is sort of reacting, like, making sure, you know, I'm zigging.
Yeah.
And I have to do that on a practical, and it's not only on an artistic level. It's like, this is my job. Like, I've packed myself in a corner where my job is to get projects up based on me being the lead character in some way, protagonist. Like, that's all. No one wants me on any other level than that. And then, so, yeah, somehow I talked to my dad. My dad brings this up with me. He goes, I cannot believe you've managed to sustain this career. It's, like, amazing because there are so far that I've always had something else lined up next, but it's like, it's pretty, it's like my dad would prefer if it was like the olden days where, you know, like I had a job at the ABC, you know, where I turn up to the office, you know, like where it's just more stable, like than that. But yeah, it's really, it is kind of strange how, because I haven't come up with really, unless you're going to say I'm the franchise. Right. Unless you're going to say I'm the franchise, like I haven't come up with anything easy where it's like, well, okay, I've done that. Now I'll do season two of that. Now I'll do season, like every time I have to like come up with something new, like, yeah, like my books, like one's a true crime in Mississippi. One's more gonzo journalism about extremists in Australia. So
well,
I get to the same.
I just and finished then that. New, yeah, yeah. I just finished that book, and I've just started Puff Piece as well. But you know, just reading Depends What You Mean by Extremist was one of the reasons I really wanted to kind of reach out to you, because I've also just been getting really sucked in as a like an observer of kind of extremism, and your book is just is a really fun read. Absolutely loved it. But I mean, that must have been like a really wild thing. I mean, you seem to always do this, like just hang around with the wrong crowd, I think, as you put it, like the amount of white supremacists you've met, spend time with. I mean,
isn't that crazy how, like, for instance, you mentioned you'd watch Versus God. That's like 2000 and I think that was filmed maybe in 2003 or something like that.
Wow.
Or 2004, right? And I can't tell you, when I like in that's in there's a segment in that where I like go to a bunker with this with the Ku Klux Klan. I can't tell you when that came on TV, like, because people hadn't thought about the Klan like in 20 years. Like, people weren't obsessed with things like that, like they are now, and white nationalism. People were just so confused. They were like, what the hell? There's still a Klan? Oh my God. And John's hanging out with this Klan. Holy hell. Like, people are just so freaked out. But look how the world's just caught up, like the backdrop to the world, that now that's just staple. That's staple. Like, it's almost like if you do a list of what are people going to investigate, it's going to be white supremacy.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's going to be And like everyone's like just hanging out with white supremacists now, and everyone's and even this whole world of like the fringe. The fringe isn't the fringe anymore.
Hmm.
The fringe of like the conspiracy world, and that used to be just that's like how why people like Louis Theroux and me and writers like John Ronson, that's why we had gigs. It's like people were so curious. It was like, oh my God, these guys go off and they go to the fringes and they find out these things and these conspiracies that, God, we haven't even heard of. But now, geez, something's happened. Now it's like, now that's just the mainstream, which is another reason why my new book's about the cigarette industry, because I was like, my beat has just been, my beat has been taken by everyone. Everyone's doing my beat now. And that was another reason. Yeah, but it was, I mean, it's even that book's kind of crazy, which like another thing that can be kind of lost is that when I started researching that book, depends what you mean by extremist, which I think I started like May 2015. And it was just, the thing was these lefties were organizing a counter rally because I was saying that skinheads were going to be protesting on the streets of Melbourne. It was like, I can't hear how like insane that felt. Like it was like maybe at a stretch, like skinheads in Queensland or whatever. What the hell in inner city douchebag hipster Melbourne, really outside the freaking cafes on Spring Street, we're going to be having these skinheads. So I was like, what the hell is this? And then I just turned up and I was just so fascinated, and I started seeing these ecosystems within the bigger system, like one of the big, when I say ecosystems, it was like the far right has, I realized, had really changed in the last 20 years. The most notable one being that it became multicultural, kind of funnily enough, where you'd have people with like different agendas making strange bedfellows. So you'd have immigrants, like, you know, people of color who had come to Australia, but they're really evangelical Christians. So they really don't like Muslims. And then you've got these white nationalists who don't like Muslims. So somehow they've joined together.
Yeah, they've worked out their racism in a way.
You have pox with white nationalists both joining together in their kind of trying to attack Muslims or whatever. But then when I started that, I thought the book was just going to be me bumbling around with these fringe players where there's like, well, 8 of them turn up to a pub once a month for their meetings. But for me, that's like interesting enough or whatever, because this was before Trump had announced he was going to run, and this was before Pauline Hanson had announced he's going to make a stage of comeback. So then I'm following these far-right players who I just think are totally interesting enough to do a book about, but it's like they're just these fringe dwellers. And then suddenly in the background, like the alt-right, suddenly people start knowing about it. Starts becoming this mainstream concept. And then Hillary Clinton talks about the alt-right. And then the alt-right in Australia like starts getting, oh, my God, we're something or whatever. And then they start growing, and then they start feeding off each other, the alt-right and the politicians, like Pauline Hanson and the far-right on the street. They're both energizing each other. And in America, the alt-right and Trump or whatever. And it was like, and then it became this, it was like this is growing and growing in the background. And I was like, oh my God, I can't believe how lucky I was that I was like hanging out with the Australian alt-right before they even knew they were the alt-right. And so that was crazy. And but I think a mistake I made in that book, which I've improved with Puff Piece, is I do think I should have explained things. Like I really kind of go, this is a real complicated thing I'm talking about. It's about a cigarette company and their new tech, which they're saying is a healthier alternative to cigarette. It's like I can barely follow it. So if I can't follow it, why would my readers be able? So I go really slowly, and I'm always explaining exactly where I'm at. Whilst I think with my last book, I was still running along on the energy of like, oh, these are just crazy, and I love writing about craziness, and I love it all being off kilter, and I love not really telling the reader what to think or whatever, and which is kind of fine, but I think I went too far with that book. I think that book would have been better with more of a, like, me saying exactly what I mean and exactly, you know, like, and not necessarily thinking I have to always dodge around that, or although it was difficult because the cool thing about writing about cigarettes and whatever is, and this their new Philip Morris's new tech, is that I can say straightly what I'm thinking, and it doesn't come across as lame because I'm talking about something people aren't talking about. Well, so what the hell was I going to say on Depends What You Mean by Extremists? Like at the end of a chapter, go, it was then that I realized that racism is bad. Like, he would be like, shut up.
Do you ever find yourself when you're kind of hanging around these people? And I think like one of the big reasons is you seem so likable and you always find the humor in situations that you can kind of get away with hanging out with people that are just completely polar opposite beliefs or anything. But do you ever find when you're kind of spending time with these like Reclaim Australia people, or even do you ever almost find yourself getting swept up momentarily in kind of their kind of radical beliefs? Because at some points, you know, you're hanging out with these Reclaim Australia people, they're going on and on. I love that one quote you said about how all these Australians are reading the Quran and getting radicalized, but none of them are Muslim. Great, great quote. But, you know, you talk to all these people, then you go hang out with like an ISIS wannabe in Melbourne.
Yeah.
do you ever kind of almost momentarily thinking like, oh, this is maybe there's something here, and have to snap yourself out of it, and then kind of vice versa with this like Islamophobia and just, but I don't know, like, because I often find myself getting just trying to understand why people think that way. And sometimes it's almost you don't need to give them that much of a benefit of the doubt.
Well, I think part of the reason I don't get angry at these people, there's two reasons. Where there's just the storyteller instinct in me where it's like, well, this is just not going to be a good piece of writing if it's like me talking over people, me getting angry at the obvious things or whatever. So it's like, that's not even like really trying to let them hang themselves. It's more like letting them tangle themselves with, you know, like for instance, let them talk until it sort of becomes this, they've introduced this tangle of like, well, how exactly are they a white nationalist, but their wife is Asian. I just love hearing people talk and they tell their backstories and all these freaking tangles. I remember one time when I was ducking around interviewing so many different people for this Depends What You Mean by Extremists. And there was this one dude. So I kind of like lost, like sometimes I'm going so fast. I'm kind of like losing my bearings a bit. And anyway, I'm talking to this one dude who was somehow, you know, he'd come onto my radar, who was the head of one group, and he's there and he's white, I think, and he's got these tattoos and he's got some Arabic tattoos that looks like Arabic writing and other ones that aren't Arabic. I'm just looking down his arms and I really just forgot, hang on, who is he? Is this guy a skinhead, one of those white nationalists who doesn't like Muslims, or is he like this Muslim dude who's like, because why has he got this Arabic writing on his arm? I was just so confused. So usually the thing that prevents me from becoming radicalized is these people, they don't become, in some ways, like their beliefs just become more annoying. Like there's like a novelty to their extremism, their extremist beliefs the first time you meet them. And then after that, it pretty soon just becomes really annoying. You know, that way. I'm not saying they're annoying or whatever, but their beliefs. I mean, have you ever like read Mein Kampf? I haven't read it all or whatever, but it starts off cool. It's got Hitler talking about his childhood. That's really good. And then when he starts waffling about his beliefs, like the problem isn't it's offensive. Like the problem is it's really tedious. It's like, it's almost like unreadable. It's like, and so, these extremists have fairly unattractive beliefs because they're always blaming someone else, and they're usually hypocrites. So they're kind of like pompous. So all these sort of like unattractive qualities all come out in their beliefs. And then, but then, I mean, so the side where they're redeemable is that a lot of them, they're like searching for meaning, and they've gone off the rails searching for meaning, whether that's, you know, someone who's joining ISIS or someone on the far right or whatever. So you do have, like, you know, if you kind of go, oh, this person is searching for meaning and they just got it wrong, then maybe, you know, then maybe, you know, then there's redemption or whatever.
I think it's that adamant, you know, when they just get so adamant, and it's just like, it just turns into this real tunnel vision kind of thing. And, you know, you're seeing it more and more, and like the book ends just as like Trump's got in, and you mentioned Pauline Hanson kind of making a comeback. But since kind of the book coming out in 2017, it just seems like there's been this increase. I don't know if I'm just paying more attention or if it's just this big tidal wave of kind of far-right extremism, or maybe I'm just seeing it through a narrow lens. But, you know, through Trump and then coronavirus, it's everywhere you look in like, and it's, smaller it's, ways
but
sometimes.
It's become so tangled and kind of different to what it was in my book. Like, the one thing that's really interesting, because it was never that big in America. Like, people don't know this. In America, their far right was dead against or focused on Jews being the puppet masters. And then through that, they didn't like Mexicans and they didn't like black people, right? And the far right in America, even at its peak of the alt-right, they weren't really that focused on Muslims. So Australia had a very different experience because our far right decided to use Muslims as a backdrop for trying to pitch their views. And I'd say they were trying to do that because the far right in Australia, at least, they're always trying to hitch their ride to things that have more acceptability than their neo-Nazism, which is everything. So, for instance, they could see that on like current affairs shows, there was like, stories about halal certification and is it bad? And then there's also, you know, like, because there's like terrorism, sometimes there's like legitimate, you know, news stories or whatever, and about, Islamic terrorism or whatever. So they're like, oh my God, this is something that's acceptable to discuss in the mainstream. So that's why I reckon in Australia they lent into Islam, the far right, when I was writing that book, because it was like something that they could pretend, they were like, it was like, you know how you've got Dick Smith and he's really concerned about jobs going overseas. And so we're like that, except but they're Nazis. And but then it was like, they tried to make out, they were just like, are you concerned about terrorism and stuff? And so they were trying to make out like they were just normies or something like that. But in America, for whatever reason, it was never really focused that much on Islam. And I think part of the reason for that is the American far right, they're isolationists. So they're like, for instance, they're not really for the military. They're against the military because they're like, part of their thing is America shouldn't be an empire. America, like, we shouldn't go overseas and be fighting wars and for other countries. So it just becomes like this tangled thing that almost like I imagine anyone listening is like, oh, that's too weird, I don't understand it. But that, so in this way, they didn't really have they kind of agreed with parts of like when Muslims were saying, well, why is America coming into going into Arab and Persian and Muslim lands with their troops or whatever? Like, the far right in America was like, yeah, we agree with you Muslims or whatever. So it was like, anyway, so one of the strange things interesting things is, yeah, it's even in Australia, focusing it on Islam has really gone down. And, things just change so fast. It's really hard. And I'm not even focusing on it at the moment. So there's just stuff I kind of pick up when I'm spooling through the Drudge Report or something like that, or Twitter, or something like that. And that, one of the things I've noticed, which I thought was kind of interesting, is that if you're Muslim and you want to draw attention to Islamophobia, the way to do it now, because at the moment we're living in a thing where everything's been cast in, by a racial lens, is you don't go, oh, people are bigots against Muslims, people are Islamophobic. You don't go that. What you have to do is you have to say, us Muslims, we're people of color. And so we're part of the people of color who are being screwed over. And it's like, has to be delivered through that lens to sort of like have breakthrough and have sort of like an audience understand it or being sympathetic to you. Because I saw this thing on Drudge Report the other day where it was talking about how Apple has censored the Quran app in China. And so if we had a more sophisticated take on the world, surely that would be like, what a kind of solid gold example of like Islamophobia. Like, what the hell are you like taking away their like that? Surely we lefties should be outraged by that. And, you know, like, but it's just too hard. It's like the Muslims in China are going to have to figure out some way to frame themselves as we're the Black Americans of China. And the Chinese Communist Party, they're the Donald Trump white people or something of China. And that's why it's bad that our Quran has been censored. But yeah, so it's just, I don't know, it's so crazy. And with this coronavirus, it's real, and the conspiracies around that, and how I feel like people, you've got both neo-Nazis and white nationalists who are seeing this as an opening to try to, you know, cover themselves. Like, it's like, oh, you know, we're sympathetic with this and, you know, and why not kind of join us? Because
yeah, well, that's been what's really kind of bugging me through a lot of this. You know, we've got this kind of, I don't know, freedom movement, if you want to call it that, more like anti-lockdown, anti-everything related to COVID movement. But I've been paying quite a bit of attention to this guy, this bloke who you cover quite a bit in your book, Avi Yemini, and he's just reinvented himself again as this voice of injustice throughout this entire pandemic, and he actually features quite a lot in your book. You hung out a fair bit about him. Like, what's your impressions of this guy? Is he, because you were training with him and stuff? Is he a buddy of yours, or like, it's quite a, like, I don't know, alarming character.
You definitely have a lot of people who are recasting themselves for the new situations. And so that's what's kind of confusing about trying to work out what's going on with these lockdown movements, these freedom movements, these conspiracy movements, because it just seems like it's even with, I mean, this is like, these are a bit of a controversial take or whatever, but I also feel that with that what was that thing, that raid on the Capitol, the insurgency on the Capitol or whatever, like, it was, people just get caught up in things, and I reckon it's really credible to say that there are people within these movements. I'm not talking about the leaders so much, but like people, and they're confused and they're wrong, but they're not there as like, oh my God, I'm a neo-Nazi and I hate Jews and I hate black people or whatever like that. Like they really are just confused. And I even take that to the extent of because you have people, if listeners don't know, I'm Jewish, but you have people who go along with yellow stars that Jews will put on Jews during the Holocaust to identify them. And so you have these anti-vaxxers and these people in these freedom movements and anti-lockdown people, and they're like, I'm going to wear a yellow star because we're getting targeted like the Jews.
Really?
And like, obviously it's like offensive and it's silly or whatever, but even in that case, I'm not sure they're trying to be, I think they're just, I really reckon they're not trying to, they're not coming from it from a like, oh, I hate Jewish people and that's why I'm doing this. And having said that, Jesus, there's plenty of anti-Semitism out there, so I'm not denying that or whatever. I'm just saying in this particular case, but, and I just bring that up to sort of like talk about how confusing it is to try to unpick this sort of like COVID, Like I feel like even far right's not quite the right word for it, because
it's like, a confused
why,
movement.
Why are they? Yeah, why are they far? Like exactly why are they far right or whatever? It's a very strange situation. It used to be a lot easier, man. Let me tell you, when I was young, there was the right, there was the left. Corporations were right wing. Yeah. Counterculture was left wing. The offensive people were left wing. The offended people were right wing. everything was like a lot easier back in my day, son. So you have to exist in this confusing time, which wasn't as much fun as when I was a kid.
Well, it is great to kind of hear your humorous takes on it throughout the book. Because I think that's one thing everyone really, really kind of needs. And that's one thing you really do is you take on the heaviest subjects that are. I mean, even in John Safran versus God and race relations, you're constantly playing with the Israel-Palestine conflict, which is horrific. But you just bring these absurd, hilarious kind of takes on them or sketches to it. It's great.
I think when I was, I don't know how much is conscious and how much is more after the fact. I go, oh, I did that thing or whatever. But when I was very small, I used to watch Marx Brothers films with my dad. So the Marx Brothers are these black and white comedy troupe. You probably know Groucho Marx. He's got a cigar and he's the kind of guy, even if you don't know him, you see the face and you go, oh, that face or whatever. And there's Harpo Marx. He doesn't talk. He just squeaks on a horn and he's got a golden afro. He's got Chico Marx. Anyway, there's the three of them and they're always they're like slapstick or whatever. But I noticed with their films, they always set up a pompous or serious situation or before they kind of went all slapstick, and you needed that bit. So Night at the Opera, so you set up how the opera is really posh and high class and highbrow and all the people there very sophisticated and uptight or whatever. So you invest time in all that. And then when they come in, when Groucho comes in, you're like, oh my God. And it just makes it so much funnier. And then I think they're so much funnier than Abbott and Costello or the Three Stooges, because they set up this whole serious situation in which their silliness comes in. So I kind of feel like I instinctively picked that up when I started doing docos about how religion is something very serious. Mm-hmm. And you just not, it just makes the things I do just seem like, oh my God, in such a sort of a better way than if I was just silly or if that seriousness wasn't there. So, because I do remember this woman saying to me, she goes, oh, when I watch your TV stuff, when there's the wide shot at the start and it's a mosque or a temple or a synagogue or whatever, it's and then you walk into shot and you're walking towards it, she goes, oh my God, it feels so uncomfortable in my stomach or whatever. So I really feel I do need this sort of serious footing or something, backdrop with that, doing what the Marx Brothers do, set up how the opera is very important and sophisticated and da 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 da. And I feel like I need to do that for my silly stuff to work. Right. And even in this latest book, Puff Piece. So then obviously, another example of that is, of course, hang out with the Klan and, hang out with dangerous people. That's really serious or whatever. But even in Puff Piece, where I do all this thorough journalism, I really feel like the thorough journalism in it is sort of creating the important backdrop for me to then allow me to be silly and play around in it. And I really felt when I was just doing all the journalism and just making sure it was all thorough and I was finding out new things and everything, I was, even if it was just subconscious, I reckon that was me sort of going, I need to have this for the fun stuff to work. You know, I guess in Puff Piece, I could have made it a bit simpler. Just go, cigarettes kill people or something, and then do shtick about that. But the silly shtick is so much, works so much better because the journalism is so thorough and dense or whatever. Like, so, yes, I'm a kind of exploiting journalism to be so I can, I'm being a good journalist so I can be silly.
It is great that you're kind of jumping back into the topic of cigarettes is a funny one, and you kind of point this out pretty early on in the book, but
yeah.
You know, we're like currently dealing with a public health crisis with the pandemic and everything, but you know, everyone completely accepts cigarettes. I mean, you say that, what is it, like a year, I think you say at the start of the book that it kills a bit over a Holocaust every year, kind of. Like,
yeah, yeah, a Holocaust and a quarter each year.
Like, it's insane.
And yet, 52 million people die of everything each year, so everything is 52 million people. Out of that, 8 million out of 52 million people who die each year is cigarette-related. Yet, it's like somehow, because Philip Morris, they're the Marlboro people, because they just win on all levels. Somehow, that both happens, and also we think like the cigarette issue is like this boring, dead, bygone era issue. So like, oh, great, John, why don't you grow some sideburns and put on some bell-bottom trousers while you investigate cigarettes? Oh, thanks, John. Great. Oh, cigarette companies. So how does that – so Philip Morris somehow, just because they have all the luck in the world, They've even got that on their side, that people think it's a dated issue when it's clearly not a dated issue. It's very much of the zeitgeist for the hearse drivers driving these people to the cemeteries. Very zeitgeist issue for them. Very zeitgeist for the cancer cells growing in the bodies of people who smoke cigarettes, and for the nurses who, plugging in the iron lungs at the hospital. Very a bit, very zeitgeist issue for them, but for some reason everyone thinks it's a dated issue.
But you always point out you know, hypocrisies in society, which I love, and even just starting this new book does make me think about, you know, the massive focus for the last 2 years that we've had on public health, that the whole planet has come to a standstill, yet, you know, cigarettes just completely go through. Also, the anti-vaxxers are so precious about experimental drugs going into the body, yet they'll probably light up a cigarette. And that's kind of one argument I've often said to like conspiracy theorist friends, is like, you know, there's all this worry about these secret plots for depopulation stuff, yet you've got a company like Philip Morris or any cigarette company that they literally, their goal is to addict you and then ultimately kill you. They're just selling death sticks, and that's completely accepted by society. Like, do you think cigarettes should be legal, or do you like what?
People should be warned about them and stuff. I mean, this is where like, so there's two levels to this. One is what do I personally think? And then there's also, I live in a society, and maybe I'm not the one to make this decision because I'm just maybe it is good that there's people more hardline than me. So like, just me personally, like, yeah, it's like, if people want to smoke, they can smoke. But then maybe that's the wrong attitude to have. And maybe, and you know, I had this ex-girlfriend who would say to me, she'd go, oh, John, you just have all these like, hey, do what you want things because you're not an addict or whatever. And I think we're talking about like heroin or something. She goes, you don't know what it's like to grow up where, you know, you have people in your friendship circle and they take heroin and everything. And it's easy for you because you grew up without that, John, or whatever. So I don't know, maybe there should be some hardline dictatorship of like banning cigarettes. I definitely wouldn't, you know, I'd definitely go along with society and say, well, society has decided cigarettes should be banned and I'm a part of society, and this is I'm not going to die on the hill of, hey, cigarettes are really bad and they're going to kill you, but
yeah
but if you want,
yeah,
it's- but yeah generally speaking, it's like, and also I can't be a hypocrite in that, I mean, you'll see in the book, like, I just put in my mouth anything that's put in my mouth. So I've really somewhere along the line, I've really lost the right to have like some high moral ground of, you know, telling people they can't smoke or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just more telling them, you know, oh, this is how Philip Morris is trying to trick you.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a difficult one because I totally, you know, I just think, look, if you want to smoke, smoke. However, there is like a deep psychological plan embedded in the product to get you hooked and literally just make people addicted. I mean, if they were non-addictive, maybe that would be a could remove the chemicals that really just hone in on addicting you. That would possibly be an answer without, getting rid of cigarettes altogether. But it's a funny subject that's just accepted by all, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I should have looked into that. Like, why isn't anyone? There's people who like in the vaping who like. Sort of like set up a process of like there's this much nicotine in your first vaping pod, and then as the months go on, decrease the nicotine, and then you'll be vaping without any nicotine, and then maybe you can put the whole thing aside. So there is that in vaping, but yeah, you're right, there's not that in cigarettes. Yeah, where's this low nicotine cigarette?
Yeah,
yeah. Why wouldn't they do that?
Don't ban the tobacco. Just ban the additives or whatever that's in them. But I don't know. Hey, I'm sure you've been asked this many, many times, and it's going back a long time ago. But when I first watched John Safran versus God,
is this you going to try to like in this roundabout way try to trick me into talking about the exorcism episode?
Yeah. That's exactly what I'm trying to do. I left that show being so confused. And I'm sure you've been flogged, but...
No, because... So I got exercised and then...
It's so intense that episode.
And then people got annoyed because I didn't explain what happened. And people were like... And so what I reckon possibly I just got hypnotized or whatever. But, like, it's not like... You know, like I've never acted before or after. So it's not like I pretended I couldn't act the entire time leading up to that episode. And I've continued the fakery for afterwards of pretending I can't act. But just for that one episode, I just worked out how to give an Academy Award winning performance. So it wasn't that. I wasn't like faking it, but he probably, I mean, you know, I'll go along with you. Hypnotize me.
Did it have a big effect on you kind of after it was all done and dusted, releasing it, looking back? Like, because it looks very much like you're completely out of control. Like, I mean, even whatever happened, like, did that have a kind of lasting effect on you?
Nah, people have told me I need another exorcism. So I wish it did have a lasting effect on me. But, yeah, it's just you can only do it once, really.
And, more psychologically, not necessarily about being purified or anything, but just actually seeing being
manipulated. It was definitely good, like being able to scream, like giving yourself permission to just scream and scream. So it was sort of, yeah, it was like a fun way and very satisfying way to kind of release your your muddy stress that's like floating around you. And so, it was good. I'd love to scream again. I recommend exorcisms for everyone.
Well, I also listened to your podcast series on John Safran versus the occult. And there's another exorcism in that with that Muslim lady and the getting rid of the jinn. And I mean, yeah, my rational brain just thinks like all rubbish. But then you hear the story; it's really compelling. It's extremely kind of compelling. Hearing this woman explain her whole experience, then getting exercised. I mean, it's pretty intense. But I was wondering, kind of linking it with your experience, whether. And focusing so much on religion throughout all your work, like what are your kind of thoughts on like, I don't know, entities entering people? Is it like, what's going on?
I don't.
It's pretty.
I just don't. I don't. I don't know. I mean, I hope it's true that they do. I mean, but, you know, the atheists make some fairly compelling cases that. But I personally hope it's true, and I'm happy to operate as if it's true. So, but, yeah, like, it's hard to argue with these skeptics because they but I don't know. I feel like we've been less – people, like, really are down on religion a bit, but I feel like some problems – like to say all these – like even like we're talking about like these white nationalists in Australia looking for meaning or whatever, and all these right wingers turning up on the streets. Like they just need some meaning in their life. And I kind of feel like they have to turn up to church each week. That'd be like, maybe they'd be like, they'd get it there and then they wouldn't become these violent nationalists or whatever. So yeah, that's the problem with kind of being dark on religion and just saying, oh, you know, close down the churches and all that stuff, is that, there's just going to be a whole, like, people are just still going to be looking for meaning. And then where are they going to go? They're going to go to these dangerous extremist groups in some cases. Like, they're not going to. So be careful what you wish for.
Right. I mean, even like with that lady who got exorcised, I think at the very end, you're kind of talking, weighing up, could it be mental illness or what? But I wonder whether it's one of those things that if she can now actually put it on that jinn spirit or whatever, is that necessarily a bad thing? If that helps her get through that, then well, what is the problem with that?
Well, that's what I've heard from psychologists over the years, is that you can engage with someone on their reality. And so... yeah, totally. So it's like if a person's grown up in where there's a belief system where, yeah, the entity in them is demonic or whatever, and then you can help get that out of them, then sure, why not? So yeah, I'm very pro exorcism. I've got a whole I reckon I've read more exorcism books than most. In fact, I'm really sure. I'm sure most people have read zero or whatever. I've got, like, I'm looking at this thing. One, two. Let's have a look here. These are just ones that are they don't even fit into two hands. These are just all these books about this isn't like about the devil or religion. These are all specifically about exorcisms and their look, I've got both issue one and issue two of An Exorcist Tells His Story and Exorcist More Stories by Gabrielle Amorth, who was the Vatican's exorcist. There's a bit of a trend, I think, maybe in the late 60s or something, around that time that what's that book then film that came out, Rosemary's Baby, came out, where there was a bit of a kind of pulp kind of exorcist story. See, this one, when's this book from? Why am I? No, oh, well, this is as late as 1987. I thought it would have been earlier. Malachi Martin, The Possession and Exorcism of Five Contemporary Americans Hostage to the Devil. And I went through a stage where I was like reading all these books about people's exorcism stories and watching all these exorcism films, and feel like it's a bit, people aren't into it as much anymore. I don't know what happened.
Is there any within the kind of the Jewish religion?
Totally, yes. Yeah, definitely. One of my favorite books, which I've lost or someone's borrowed, is exactly about that. It's about how there used to be Jewish exorcisms. Because Judaism used to be, it still is for the really religious guys. It's like really grounded in like ritual and mysticism and superstition, like so many things that when I grew up, I just didn't ruminate over them that much. You know how, like, for instance, if you're Christian, oh, there's a Christmas tree or something, and you just says, oh, okay, there's a Christmas tree, and like you just don't think about it. So there's all these things in Judaism, like the mezuzah on the door, which is this parchment where, like, in Hebrew, there's a scripture written on it. And you have it on the doorpost, and that's mystical. It's like what the hell is that? That's like crazy. It's like Judaism is when you read the Torah. I recently read the five books of Moses, a new translation or whatever. And there's pretty much like voodooism in it, like something right. that's more equated to like for instance, and when I say that, I mean, they'll talk about the building of the temple and they'll say, oh, this is how the temple has to be built. Like when, and they're talking about the temple in Israel and it becomes, it's like when the Messiah comes, the temple's going to be built or whatever. But anyway, they lay out like what the rules of the high priests are there. And they've got these instructions and it's like, it's about like ripping the heads off pigeons and rubbing the blood on the wall. It's like, it's so insane. And it's just, Judaism's just like has become really, because it's become so cultural as opposed to religious. And right. because people think Jews have just kind of assimilated a bit more into the normie culture or whatever like that. It's easy to forget that it was like, it is just another like vivid, exciting, basically voodooism. and so there used to be exorcisms. And one of the things I remember from that book is that it was talking about how sometimes a Jewish exorcist and a Muslim exorcist, they'd cooperate because to try to confuse the demon. So for instance, if there was a demon in a Muslim dude, maybe the Muslim exorcist would get the Jewish exorcist over, and then the Jewish exorcist is kind of doing his ritual over the Muslim, and it's going to confuse the devil inside because the demon's like used to the Muslim dude, and like, what's this strange thing of this Jewish dude doing it? So there used to be interfaith exorcisms. We should reintroduce that. That'd be good, interfaith exorcisms.
That really actually did come to mind listening to your occult chat with that Muslim lady. And because I always just thought, I don't know, I thought exorcisms, Christianity. And then I was, you know, when she was getting exercised, I was kind of thinking, well, good thing she's got a Muslim exorcist. that seems to get this jinn out of her. And I was actually thinking whether this interfaith exorcism could actually exist.
Yeah, it'd be good.
Yeah.
When I was reading the Bible, it's so hilarious how it's wild. First of all, the Bible is wild. Like, you have to sort of understand that it was written in a previous time, so there's knots and things that don't make sense, and also things drag on a bit more than if it was edited today or whatever like that. But within that, it is just so insane, like the violence and the sex and all this stuff that you just, you know, like if you just grow up and you just, you know, there's sometimes you see like on kids' TV shows like Noah's Ark or, you know, David and Goliath and all this sort of like real easy stuff or whatever. It's like, no, the Bible is like insane. And the way it's kind of like glossed over for kids, like, oh, here's your picture stories from the Bible and here's like a dove over the ark as God has, you know, and really glossing over that God just genocided all those people. And there's also, God, what is that one? I don't want to talk about it. There's a real, like, salacious sex one that where a woman hides, she uses her body to kind of like hide a stolen objects and stuff like that. It's really,
yeah, right.
It's really full on. Anyway, so I've read the. So the Torah is the first five books of Moses, but now I've got to move on to the other books. So some of the stuff you think is in the Bible, like, isn't actually in the Bible, like it's not in the Torah, like things like David and Goliath is actually, or Samson and his hair, that's actually in like later books of the Bible.
Right.
Anyway, who cares?
Well, talking about, you're kind of mentioning the craziness of the Bible and just, you know, how many miracles and just, in you know, really crazy stories. And then, you know, compared to like certain cults like Scientology or something where they they believe evil Lord Xenu was, you know, took everyone's souls and dropped them in a volcano and something. But, you know, I mean, the more we lean in the direction of science, I mean, there's no reason to believe there couldn't be aliens out there at all. So it's it's funny how we just quickly do label the absurdity of Scientology beliefs.
Can I stand up for the Torah? Can I stand up for the Torah?
Which sure.
Is, that's the five books of Moses, the Jewish. So it's like that's the Old Testament, like, and then the New Testament is Jesus and all that stuff. So what's really Zen? That's probably the wrong word. But what's really like a bit safer about the Torah is, even though it's violent and hypocritical and all this stuff like that, is you're largely allowed to take it that way. So for instance, you don't have to think that Abraham or Noah or Moses, you don't have to think they're like good people. Like, or you definitely you don't have to think they're not flawed people. Mm. And you're even all into a limit, you're even allowed to think that of God, really. So it just makes, it means you're not like having to like always reverse engineer into the horrific scripture into something good and pretending it's not there, which I've noticed some other religions. So even the New Testament, it's like Jesus has to be perfect.
Right.
And so therefore all these things that kind of make that a bit clunky for it to work, then it's like you have to get agitated by that. Whilst in Judaism, like Moses, like who's more important than that? Wouldn't he be like the one of the lead holy prophets or whatever? You're allowed to think he's not he's a flawed person and even not a good person in some ways. And so yeah, okay. You just don't have that stress. You don't have that stress. Or the other one, like with Islamic scripture, where it's like, you know, Muslims get wound up because people are going, oh, well, I read this thing about Muhammad in your own scripture, and he did this, and he married a six-year-old, and then it's just gonna, it's like, it's kind of like it's irritating to like a devout Muslim. So it's like, whilst there's plenty of people marrying not marrying 60-year-olds, but it's like, I think there's definitely incest, for instance, or implied incest, I think maybe, and yeah, just all this stuff, but you don't have to, it's not like, oh, okay, well, that was good or something. It's just like a bit more like stress-free, even if you're a devout Jew, let alone not a devout, because obviously if you're not devout, you can just go, oh, yeah, well, it's just bullshit or whatever. But even if you're a devout Jew, it's just not as stressful, the bad stuff in the Torah, because you're allowed to, you don't have to worship these characters, or it's not a condition of entry that, like, oh, Moses was such a great man that he never made a mistake or whatever like that. Like there's even things of, there's even like fights with God, like holy rabbis, you know, who renowned rabbis, they're always like sort of like picking little holes in the Torah, and God said this here and God said that there. And so, yeah, it's chill.
I've always struggled to kind of understand religion, which like kind of shows the hypocrisy in myself. So I've always just thought, like, as I was young, religion bad, you know, there'd be so many less wars without religion when I was young. And as I've gotten older, I've kind of like had my own little, I guess, spiritual inquiries with you know, New Age spiritualism, or Ram Dass was really kind of my guy, this psychedelic.
Who's your guy?
Ram Dass. He's this, he was Timothy Leary's right-hand man back in the 60s, but then he went to
Timothy
India.
Leary.
Yep. And then kind of got right into Hinduism and Buddhism and things like that. So I can already just see like the hypocrisy of myself thinking, you know, judging religions. But I found this niche one that works for me, which is kind of which is absurd, but in a way. But I actually think going through so much of your work, it is a great access point for someone who's never quite really understood religion like myself, and it actually has made me much more curious to actually learn more about, yeah, I mean, get reading the staple religions, like reading the Bible or reading the Torah or the Quran would be fascinating things to kind of
I read there's this book in India in Hindu scripture called the Ramayana, and there was a, do I have it? And I've got this one that was written for, you know, like, I'm sure if you're a proper Hindu, you're like, John, you just read this stupid one that was made for idiots in the West. But regardless, it's like amazing. It's such an amazing story. And scripture can just be like the real, I mean, scripture is the problem with scripture is also that, like, what's the problem with old books as well, where you have to get in your head, they were written in a different time and where people were desperate for material. And so things drag on a bit. Like I hear Charles Dickens is quite the chore to get through because it's like, yeah, but you got to understand, like, people have to wait like 4 months to get a book, and then they're going to really relish all the detail and all that stuff. And then there's also, I guess, the other thing with scripture is often it's pieced together from different sources or whatever. So that's almost like the main thing I'd say before going into scripture is like reading a bit about the context in which it was written, so you're not getting annoyed by how it's dragging on or it's right. repeating itself, or there's a contradiction here or there. One of the Bible I read, the five books of Moses I read, it's got a commentary by this guy called Robert Elter. And the really good thing about the commentary is you can look down at it and just go, oh, I'm not mad. Like, because right. it will say something like them, like it will refer to God as them, and they'll be like going, what's, I don't understand that, because is them referring to God, but God's one, or whatever, or is them referring to the Israelites mentioned in the sense? Like, you're getting confused, and you just look down to the footnote, and it just says, people get confused here because it says them, and go, oh, okay, great, I'm not mad. Or just all the little, like, something happened 5 pages ago where Moses had a red hat, and now he's got a back the front baseball hat, or no, whatever it is, like there's this little difference or whatever, and they just look into the footnotes and they just go, oh, people notice that Moses has 2 different hats, and it's like, oh my god, so I'm not mad or whatever. That's a kind of the real stressful part about reading old scriptures. It's just it's like trying to understand or get your head around the long dragged on bits that aren't as interesting, appear to be as interesting. I mean, also all the little contradictions. But then the other thing is, I just say, I'd join some group, and you know, there's no shortage of groups in the real world and online. Like, I reckon that'd be a less stressful way to get through some old religious book, is like reading it with others or reading it with an expert teacher or something like that. Because then you won't go mad.
Yeah. What's the best religion, John? You've read so many of the scriptures and stuff. What's the best one? What wins?
I feel like I haven't got enough guilt. I feel like so Judaism's pretty cool, but I just wish there was more guilt, because I feel like I needed a bit more guilt in my life. And Hinduism, I really like the Ramayana, so that's kind of cool.
It's pretty trippy.
I'm not really into any kind of sect that tries to be normal. I'm just kind of thinking you're kind of like defeating the purpose of – I always have that fight with Father Bob where he was always like trying to like, hey, man, make Catholicism more accessible. So he's not going to wear the priest's robe. He's going to turn up in his Adidas tracksuit or something. And it's like – no, people want that. Like, people want a bit of theatre or whatever. Like,
right.
The boring ones, I feel like really bad. I'm not going to say it. I feel like it seems a bit mean to say what the worst religion is, but there's a certain religion that believes that you shouldn't try to affect the world, and it just kind of ends like, it's so
as in everything like, is how it should be.
No, like, you're not meant to vote, for instance, because God should take care of things. And you really got to be careful about trying to affect things, because then you're doing what God should do. And I've tried to do a story on this religion a couple of times, but each time it's just too boring because nothing happens. I was driving with someone in the car and they got lost and I said, are you allowed to look up the Melways or is that like, or should God just guide us forever or whatever? And so, yeah, that's the worst religion, that one, which I won't
that
mention.
One, sure, sure. When you are like digging in.
You know
in,
what I'm talking about, religion where you can't vote? Yeah.
When you are like digging in on these, I mean, I assume you must get a lot of backlash because like in your book on extremism, your phone just seems to be always going off by randoms. Like how are people, how are people getting your number and just contacting you? And
you know, especially in social media, it's pretty easy. Like,
yeah, okay.
Like, you know, like I'm on open on all channels or whatever.
Do you worry about you know, your safety when you're kind of you're covering things that people have dedicated their whole lives to or you're, you know, because a lot of the things you
Yeah. I mean I just have to kind of approach it as and be a bit naive where it's just kind of go along with that thing of, well, like, you know, really, what are the chances?
Yeah.
And so far that's worked for me.
Yeah.
Although someone according to one white nationalist, I nearly got thumped whilst writing that book. He contacted me after the book came out and said, when we were up in Bendigo, they were going to hose you down and I stopped them.
Yeah.
So, and I was just thinking, God damn it. Like the bruises would have healed by now and that would have been a killer chapter. Thanks a lot, jerk.
They all seem to like you though a bit, you know. They claim that they don't like you in the moment, but then they'll buy you tequila shots, and then they'll kind of welcome you in.
Well, I guess I'm just like, yeah, I guess I do listen to, but like, because I am interested in this. Yeah. I do find it all interesting. So I think they kind of like that someone's listening to them. Yep. It's all become like crazy now. Like there's this new like woke rule where it's like don't platform Nazis and stuff like that. When, like, what does that even mean? So, what, just sit on Twitter and shriek, but like, don't leave your house and investigate? Like, that's what it means. I really am dead against that. I believe the entertainment value of everything increases if there's a Nazi there. So, I'm like, platform more Nazis or whatever. No, it's like, I get what they're saying. They're saying that don't, like, you can't, like, just let people unquestioningly spread their, you know, their racism or whatever. So I kind of get that. But I do feel like I generally think a lot of what people write about is everyone's just trying to get attention and have an angle. And so I really feel like shrieking about platforming Nazis is just someone trying to have an angle. Like,
well,
yeah, that's why I like leaving the house. Like I'm a big fan. That's why I'm against coronavirus. It's stopping me from leaving the house.
Yeah.
Because I'm a big fan as a writer, as a storyteller, of leaving the house, because then you can just explore things. You can let things speak for themselves. There's all that. And so just, when you don't leave the house, you're just there, but you want to be a writer. You're just there. All you can do is have this almost like this arms race of being the most histrionic kind of person. Mm. And like to what end? And like on some surface level, you're moral, like, yeah, well, I don't know, whatever. So that's the only option you have left. It's like like if I go down to a neo-Nazi rally, and I let them speak and say things that are contradictory and ironic, and then I've got my humorous little quips or whatever. Like, you get to understand their world, you get to understand where they're coming from, and you get to understand why they're ridiculous. And there is activism in it, because you're making these people who don't want to look ridiculous look a bit ridiculous or whatever, right? But if you just never leave the house, all you can do is like, Nazis,
yeah, la la need, la la la.
They need to be punched. Ooh, you have a problem with me saying punching Nazi? Oh, are you a Nazi? Ooh, and just like everything has to be like, it's like, and I believe Donald Trump's son Barron, is that his name?
Yeah.
Barron.
Yeah.
Where am I? I think he should be dropped down a well and eaten by ants. Oh, really? Oh, you've got a problem with that? do you? Why? It's like everything has to just be this like hysteria, like that gets nowhere and isn't as cool as my stuff. So I just don't believe this thing of like, yeah, this whole no platform thing, like don't platform, is just basically writers who are too lazy or scared to leave their house and investigate everything, trying to like hang shit on those of us who do. And the other thing that's kind of annoying is that all these people think they know things. Like once they know something, they think they've always known it. It's like, no, you know that because other journalists went out on the streets and investigated it. Like I noticed that when I was briefly doing court reporting, when I was a true crime writer, that you'd have all these people on Twitter like hanging shit on like the headline or some paragraph in an article written about some court thing that was written by either a Murdoch journalist or a Fairfax journalist or something like that. And they'd all be sort of like so high and mighty and pompous and sort of like attacking this article like, no, that's not how – and never was it factored into the fact that, hey, you only know about this because that journalist was down there. You did not know about this in any other way. And surely that should moderate your kind of like opinion. Like it's not like, because otherwise if this journalist didn't go down there, you'd know zero about this because you don't leave the house because you're lazy or lack curiosity or you're scared. And so,
but covering, like, I don't know. No, I couldn't agree more. But like covering things, people like Nazis and stuff, what I find fascinating is it's kind of like, fascination in cults and or even serial killers, like to a lesser extent, but trying to work out where they went wrong and also trying to figure out like, could this happen to me? And I guess that's why I asked you earlier, like, do you ever find yourself temporarily being swayed by these extreme kind of arguments? Because it's like, where are people going wrong? Why, like, and why is this increasing? I don't think
people who don't have other options, like, people kind of throw themselves around a bit until they get traction somewhere. I mean, even me as an artist or whatever, like you kind of feel like I've felt out this, maybe I'll be a rapper, maybe I'll do this or that and what kind of works or whatever. So I just reckon there are people who are kind of fine. They're not fitting into any other niche in society or whatever, or just, and then they, especially with the leaders, like, so I'm not talking about the people in these groups, but the leaders of these groups, you have like young men, like maybe they're in their mid-20s and the ship has sailed of them kind of getting authority in some other sense. Like, for instance, like if they were really, if they went to become a doctor or an architect or something where they'd be kind of respected in the community, like that ship sailed. And then also they haven't become a plumber or a builder or whatever, like or some other profession where, like, by this stage in their life, they'd have built sort of status where they get respect or have respect, people respecting them or whatever. So they're like, and so this sort of like starting up a little grouplet, a little neo-Nazi grouplet, is this sort of like shortcut for being kind of a king in a very small kingdom. And so I think there's that element to it. But yeah, there's so many layers to why these groups are working or whatever, and it's in so much as they do work.
Yeah.
But and it is, it's hard to sort of know how. I think they are dangerous because even if there's not a lot of them in a group, you don't need a lot to like groups that are like prone to terrorism, like you don't need 20 people for that. You need like a couple of people. And there's been, even in Australia, there's been like some close calls. Like we mightn't have had like one kooky person he's not in my book. I'm kind of, it's a bit of a bummer really for my book because I saw him at rallies and he did want to speak to me, but I was just confused and I just had spoken to too many people that day or whatever. But he ended up trying to, you know, he went to court, he was taken to court, he's locked up, and because he was trying in his inadequate way to kind of blow up some anarchists, and it didn't work because he was incompetent. Because he was incompetent, not because he didn't want to do it. There's been like really close calls. Like even in 2019, this wannabe jihadi, this guy who was a student at Sydney University, I want to say, and he told a court he'd bought a hunting knife to kill Jews on campus. And for some reason, I was like, obviously, I found that story interesting, but I found more interesting the fact it didn't become a story. It's like, oh, okay. for some reason, how's that not interesting or whatever? But
yeah.
But anyway, so with like, yeah, there doesn't need to be a lot of people for them to be dangerous. So I do think it is true that they are dangerous, even if you want to argue that there's not a lot of them or whatever.
Yeah. Did you see in The Age the other day, the guy got arrested for burning down a 5G tower, and then the cops went to his house and he had a 1.5 meter by 6 meter hole in his backyard that he planned to kidnap Dan Andrews and hold him hostage there.
What the hell? Jesus.
It's like, I think in the last week. And he told the cops, like, they're like, what's this hole for? And he's like, well, I was going to get Dan Andrews and put him in there and put him before a kangaroo court, he said. So, I mean, I found that one particularly funny, just of how absurd
it is. It's so confusing, isn't it? It's like, what's going on there? I don't even know how to unpick that.
Yeah.
What about how weird it is where, like, Pete Evans, celebrity chef, and
I've been trying to get him on, but he won't respond to me.
he starts posting like it's so I can't tell you how weird it is to me, these things that were just so fringe of the fringe that I was kind of like on my radar, and now they're like just front and center, because it was always a bit like ironic. I used to, like, when I'd look into these groups that were both far right, but they'd have like some left wing grounding, like, for instance, they're environmentalists,
right?
Or they're vegetarians, or, and then that whole thing of where does the conspiracies that people you associate with the left, like up until relatively recently, you'd say, oh, these people who are like in Byron Bay who are like into that stuff, they're like left wing, like, but are they? And then I noticed this, like, whatever, like 10 years ago or 15, I was like, oh, it's kind of interesting, really. You got these lefties and they're into these conspiracies, but they kind of, there's a crossover with the righties and their conspiracies. And how does that all work? Like, I noticed that at this bookshop when I used to go to in high school and then at uni or whatever, in the Melbourne CBD, called the Theosophical Bookshop.
I remember that one.
And they'd have, you'd start at one side of the shelf and there'd be like a thing on aliens are real or whatever. They're lying to you about aliens and the moon landing. It's like, okay, cool. That's kind of fun. And then it's like, oh, they're lying to you about JFK assassination. It's like, oh, okay, well, a bit more serious. And you know, a life was taken. So sort of like, it's not as easy to just kind of laugh it off, but you know, still it's kind of funny, kooky, or whatever. Then the next, it's like they're lying to you about, you know, the JFK assassination and the banks and the Illuminati. And it's like, okay, what's this about the banks or whatever? Then it's sort of like, and then like as it goes on, and basically by the, you know, you pretty soon get to it, sort of like it's the Freemasons and the Illuminati did 9/11. There's like the Jews.
Yeah, it always goes back to the Jews, doesn't it?
It goes back to the Jews. So I always notice this kind of thing of like things that seem like fun conspiracies and even fun lefty conspiracies sort of like ending up in that dark place or whatever. So yeah, it's really interesting. I could never have guessed this even like 5 years ago. Like the whole thing of like, oh, this guy on MasterChef is going to be posting pictures with Nazi symbolism on his Instagram page.
Yeah.
like, why? And then he denies it. Like, he goes, oh, I didn't know that was a Nazi symbol. It's like, okay, maybe.
Yeah.
I guess. That's like when they deny it, it's always becomes confusing. I was like, well, did you really not know that was a Nazi symbol?
I know. That was why I got out of the conspiracy game. Because the New World Order started to be referred to as the Jew World Order. I was like, wait, I'm sorry, what?
Yes.
What was that? What? Hold on, back up. And yeah, it does. It's so much of it's entrenched in anti-Semitism. I don't know why. I don't know why the conspiracy world. I mean, like you say, most of it's more shallow and it's more fun, but it's when you really like start to pry and dig deep and see like, well, what are they really saying? It does lead to this weird anti-Semitic thing. I don't know why. Didn't like it.
There's this new tangle, which I don't even know how to untangle. I barely know how to explain it, let alone untangle it, where it's so clear to me that, like, as you say, there is like this racism, so much racism is and conspiracy is like grounded in anti-Semitism, right? And on the one hand, like the left kind of agree with that, like they wouldn't deny it if on the one hand, but on the other hand, there's been this new reframing of racism, of what racism is and what racism isn't, and how different forms of racism have different heats to them, if that's the right word. And somehow, like, anti-Semitism, like racism against Jews falls out of that because it's like it's become, well, Jews are white and you can't be racist to white people. And it's like, okay. And how does the fact that like anti-Semitism is like the grounding of these far right groups and of so much racism, how does that match up? Like, it just doesn't match up. They've like 5 years ago or 10 years ago, everyone was just, no one would bother making that. No one would bother. People on the left wouldn't bother going, oh, by the way, yeah, sure, there's anti-Semitism, but you got to understand it's not as bad as anti-black racism because Jews are white. Like, they just wouldn't bother getting into that tangle. But now they do bother getting into that tangle. I'm just so freaking confused and find it really dangerous because it does get a – because people shouldn't be and like to ground it in like something real or whatever is like you have left-wingers – there's been a steady trickle in Melbourne, in Australia, of like left-wingers – vandalizing Australian businesses run by Jews and then saying, then having like these two get out of jail cards, one being, oh, it's because of the Israel-Palestine conflict. And then
right.
If you ease around that, there's this implicit, if not explicit, that there's not heat to that. There's not heat to being racist to Jews because they're white and powerful. It's like, hang on, but the white and powerful, the Jews, like attributing to Jews that they're really powerful, like that's kind of the conspiracy, man. And so, yeah, as I say, it's like this tangle that I barely know how to explain, let alone what the answer to it is. But it's like, I find it really worrying because when it comes to like the right-wing anti-Semitism, like everyone's on your side. Like, it's obviously screwed up. You know, it's not like if a Nazi vandalizes a Jewish business, the left are going to go, well, but a Jew's white. They'll sort of like, they'll stand with the Jews. But yeah, then when left-wing people do it, like just look at how the contours of, like, how confusing it is. Like, so there's this shop. It is like based on reality. Not based, this is reality. So these left-wingers vandalize a Jewish business, saying the owner is part of an international Zionist conspiracy, and because of the Israel-Palestine conflict, right? So he just ran a falafel place in Sydney Road, Brunswick, right?
So then I remember that
this
one.
Yeah. So look at this. But because the people who did it were left wing, and it's Jews, and it's Israel-Palestine thing, and Jews are white, somehow it comes out they're like, well, that's not racism. That's not,
yeah, people are like, it's complicated, okay?
Vandalizing a Jewish business in Melbourne, accusing the owner of being part of an international Zionist conspiracy is not like, oh, well, it's complicated. But look how crazy that is, because it's like next door, like a Chinese restaurant, like you're not allowed to, according to the same lefties, you're not allowed to like vandalize that Chinese Australian business, you know, in support of the Uyghurs being persecuted by the Chinese government. So you're not allowed to, you're allowed to vandalized a Jewish business, but not the Chinese business. But it gets even more tangled than that, because if neo-Nazis vandalized the Jewish business almost with the same rhetoric, if they said, hey, we're neo-Nazis and we're vandalizing this business because the owner's part of an international Zionist conspiracy, you're also not allowed to do that according to the left. So it's like, that's how like the whole thing of anti-Semitism doesn't map with sort of like the, how the left understands or processes racism or whatever. Is like, you can vandalize the Jewish business, but only if you're left-wing and not if you're a Nazi. And also you can't vandalize the Chinese business next door.
So it is anyway, this blurring though, with this kind of like new wacky extremism that I'm seeing is like, there's been a few articles of like the bleeding of the kind of the new age hippy dippy with the far right, where they're kind of meeting on these issues. And it really does fascinate me, but I think that's like a perfect example of that you just said of these. And that's what you do so well, like exposing hypocrisies in society for the left as much as the right, which I really, really appreciate. It's awesome. John, thanks so much for doing this. Like, I really appreciate it. I always really enjoy hearing your insights.
Great to talk.
Yeah, yeah. Really, really looking forward to finishing.
Great to waffle and get my thoughts a bit coherent. I like practicing a few thoughts on you like that. I've been practicing my Jewish shop vandalism thing because I'm confused about it. So I feel like if I talk it out loud, it will help.
Yep, great.
Untangle it in my head somehow.
I look forward to hearing the rest of Puff Piece, which already really enjoying. And are you working on anything else, or are you just kind of like, you are?
Yeah.
Can you talk about it?
I can't. Well, no, I'm starting my next book already because I've got, and also hopefully it'll probably be a doco type thing, but I can't really talk about that.
Yeah, great. But
we shall see that. Yeah. So, yeah. Basically, thank God, I've still got work. Dad, if you listen to this podcast, I've still got two more paid gigs lined up. So that's okay.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, mate. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. Take care. See ya.
See ya. Bye-bye.